Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
Together,
we're Blogging Heads TV.
TV.
Oops, we still haven't gotten this right after a couple years of doing this. Oh, well.
Well, I'll see you at rehearsal.
speaking of, the writer's strike. Our material is in the hands of people on picket lines, so we're stuck.
Well, I'm actually a member of the Writers Guild, so I have to say that none of the material I'm using today I wrote for myself. But speaking of not getting things right, let's talk about the Middle East Peace Conference.
Okay.
Or so to speak, being held in Annapolis on Tuesday. And what do you think? You know, they had an announcement midday on Tuesday saying that they're going to start talking again. The question is whether the last 6 years in which nothing has happened, in part because the administration hasn't bothered with it, it was a wasted opportunity, and they could have been at this non-point 6 years earlier.
I'm not sure that any of this really does any good, but the whole genesis of this peace conference is sort of interesting. I mean, it's very clear that Condoleezza Rice really, really wanted this conference and called in a lot of chits with the president. It's really clear that substantial elements of the Bush administration didn't want the conference, like Dick Cheney and so on. And the president seems to sort of wavered back and forth between wanting it and not wanting it. And I think sort of the half-heartedness of his own contribution to this effort is sort of visible in the fact that he didn't stick around for the whole thing.
Well, he obviously had other things to do. More important matters, no doubt. But it was also, you had U.S. officials, you know, telling reporters, it was in stories before and after the conference, that the U.S. didn't believe it was their obligation to tell the parties what positions to take, meaning we're not going to pressure anyone to do anything. And given the intractability of Middle East negotiations over the last few decades, one has to wonder if just bringing the parties together and saying, here, guys, do something within a year, and not really leaning on each side and trying to help them come together with compromises on some very knotty issues, is a reflection not just of half-heartedness, but of irresponsibility.
I agree. I'm not sure really if the Saudi Arabians come and refuse to shake hands with the Israelis, I'm not sure that anything is really gained, except propaganda points for Hamas and Iran and other sort of total hard cases that weren't even involved in this at all, who were saying, look, anybody who went to Annapolis is a stooge for the Americans. I mean, I think the knottiness of this issue is sort of apparent in terms of, look, if the Palestinians would agree to let the Israelis have a big chunk of the West Bank and keep some security presence along the Jordan River, then there'd be a deal tomorrow. If the Israelis would agree to pull out of the West Bank and maybe have a connecting thing to Gaza and some sort of payoff to the refugees or something like that.
And sharing Jerusalem as well.
Yeah, sharing Jerusalem, exactly.
Yeah, a bunch of.
Then the deal, either side's deal is acceptable to one side or the other, obviously not to both. The only two solutions to that kind of intractability are one, they just fight it out for the foreseeable future, which is sort of a distinct possibility, or two, the entire rest of the world gets in there and
leans on them.
And then guarantees it afterwards.
Yes.
We're going to have the West Bank and Gaza and some sort of Palestinian thing, but we're going to have not just, it can't just be Americans.
And you know what? And there's the payoff as well. It worked to a degree with Egypt and Israel. It was mainly a U.S. payoff, not the rest of the world, picking up the tab, $3 billion or so each year in assistance to Egypt and Israel. That's the other thing. It's not just leaning on, but offering, the right carrots and saying, listen, we can make things a little more comfortable for you.
Right.
Doing that together with the Saudis and even the Syrians, whoever you can bring aboard. And Jordan, of course, too. But so there's something, I don't know, it was just a very odd type of gathering to have, have this whole big deal. 40 countries, I think, came in for the 1-2-day conference. And the president and the White House saying, well, okay, glad you're here. Work it out yourselves. I mean, there's one thing I've never understood about this administration's attitude towards the Middle East. And maybe it's just pure resentment at the fact that Bill Clinton nearly came up with a deal in the last few minutes of his presidency, but they from the get-go, they've said, listen, we just don't see it as our role to take on this issue, to try to force the, or nudge or cajole the two sides to an agreement. If they come up with one, great.
Well,
I can understand politically why you don't want to get involved in this, but as the leader of the free world, it would seem to me that it's one of the things on your to-do list, and you can't just shove it aside and say, we're going to let them work it out themselves when obviously they haven't been able to.
Right. The original Bush policy, certainly since 9/11, which is almost more than 6 years ago now, was we're not going to fill the Palestinians at all. We're going to liberate Iraq and maybe Iran, and that will so and maybe Syria, and that will so transform the Middle East that the whole issue of the Palestinians is mooted. We could move the Palestinian state to Jordan. That was another favorite neocon idea, from years back. So the Bush policy.
We got all those C-130s that Trent Lott made us build. Or to use them.
Right. And so the Bush policy, that didn't quite work out as advertised. And I think at the same time, you got to say that Condi Rice, and I don't mean to pick on her, has got to be about the most feckless Secretary of State we've ever had in terms of a conference that just has no chance of success. And she's just doing it, because the State Department bureaucrats told her to. And
no, I disagree with you, Jim. I think she's doing it because she wants to do it, and given, she's looking for, listen, isn't it legacy time? All these guys are trying to find something that they can, walk out of the office with other than the Iraq War. She's decided this, it will try to be her legacy, but she has a White House that doesn't support her. I don't think she's being driven at all by the State Department bureaucrats. I think she is trying to drive them without the support of the White House.
Well, okay, maybe so. But the point is, she's still feckless in terms
of her
name on the line. She'll be remembered as the driving force behind this conference. And if nothing comes of it, then it'll just be seen as a big waste of effort. She should have measured in advance whether or not she could get the president to support her. And if she couldn't bother.
No, I think you're right. I think, the old cliche about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is, like a bicycle, you just got to try to keep it moving forward any way you can, and that usually is better than, all-out open warfare. But it seems like if you're going to have a big conference like this, doing some prep work beforehand so that there is a element of progress would be the wise way to go about this from a political and policy point of view.
Exactly. I mean, Tony Blair resigned as Prime Minister of Britain, a few months ago, and has theoretically got some job to do with helping the Palestinians or something. And, he hasn't really been heard from since. And they could have had some
He must be writing his book.
Well, maybe so, but they could have had him doing something. So yeah, Tony Blair goes to the West Bank and starts a factory or something and gets some people hired or, creates a civilian
conservation
for
that's the way you typically
exactly.
do diplomacy. Exactly. You negotiate at least a little thing that you then pretend is a big thing
right.
at the beginning of the conference. We at the conference announced that there are these economic agreements about the Gaza Strip involving electricity rates.
Right.
So whatever.
Right, exactly.
You have something
some
in place.
Some investment. The Saudis invest money in something or other or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the Jordanians agree to do something. It just sort of...
Which I don't mean to be cynical about it. That it is useful to do that stuff and to have some sense of momentum and some point of accomplishment. Other than this, have people come out and say, well, now we're going to start trying to talk again, although we disagree on everything, doesn't seem to move the ball really too far down the field.
I agree.
Well, speaking of the ball and field, our favorite ball game is the presidential election 2008. And I want to say something. I want to say something in favor, in praise of the horse race. It's very fashionable for people on the left, right, to attack the MSM, the mainstream media, for covering the presidential race as a horse race, as a sporting event. And it seems particularly on the when you're in the primary season that this time around, I think more so than ever, the differences among the candidates on their respective sides are not that gigantic. They're even they try to make them big. Hillary has been trying to have a nuclear war with Barack Obama over a difference in their health care plan, a different way of trying to do universal health care coverage. But compared to where the Republicans are or where Bush is at this point, they're much closer. And I'm all for the horse race, because covering the horse race is really covering how these people are behaving and engaging in what to now is the most important endeavor of their life. I think we learn a lot from the campaigns by watching how the candidates run them and how they what ads they put up and how they message their way through Iowa or New Hampshire, and that's probably almost as important, if not more important, than some of their policy positions, which are just as likely to change, you know, for good and bad reasons when they become elected.
I agree.
So what do you say to that?
The differences are pretty, among the candidates, are kind of noticeable.
So are you with me on this defending the horse race thing?
Yeah, the horse race is fine. I mean, you got to have something that gets them out there. Certainly, the camera doesn't lie, and you watch them this much, you do get a pretty definitive impression of all of them. And you do learn a lot. I mean, for example, let's even do the Republicans first, and then we'll do the Democrats. I found it extremely revealing that Rudy Giuliani, who's the Republican front runner, went down to Texas to talk about border security and spoke to a bunch of Hispanic Chamber of Commerce businessmen types along the Rio Grande River and talked about how important it was to have a virtual fence.
I bet you found this so revealing that you probably even wrote a column about it. Just guessing.
As a matter of fact, I did. I was so struck by this disquisition that Giuliani offered on the glories of a virtual fence that I thought, well, gee, what else should be virtual?
But wait a second. Tell our listeners, our viewers, what he meant by a virtual fence.
Virtual fence is, sensors and cameras and tripwires and so on.
You get zapped? Is there some zapping involved?
Is once you cross the border, then helicopters and SWAT teams and stuff come out and catch you.
Okay.
Which is, of course, and I thought to myself, gee, is that the way people operate their yards? Do you have a virtual fence for your dogs and pets?
You do.
Well, some people do. Most people
don't. Yes, you do.
If you have a virtual fence and you lose your dog collar, then your dog runs free. If you have a virtual fence and it rains and the dog gets zapped, then you take the dog collar off. These things that you can fight along the edge of a virtual fence. Virtual fences actually are not a very good idea in most places, which is why most people have real fences. They have real yards.
You're on your Robert Frost kick here. Good fences make let me complete the literary reference here. Good fences make good neighbors. Although when he said that, he was mocking the person. When he wrote those lines, he was mocking the person who said that.
Yeah, you're right. He was. You can argue both ways in different situations. However, you have a real lock on your front door, not a virtual lock. We have real cops, not virtual cops. We have real border patrolmen, not virtual patrolmen. And for Giuliani to say that he wanted a virtual fence is, I believe, code back to the business community and the Chamber of Commerce that wants to continue to keep the border open, that he doesn't really mean it, that he's going to talk tough because he's, after all, Giuliani. But, in fact, his plan on border security is more of the same. It's basically the Bush, Chertoff, Teddy Kennedy, John McCain, Lindsey Graham approach to border security, which is no approach to border security. So I wrote about this with some hopefully Swiftian satire quality to it in today's Newsday.com. And don't worry, folks, we'll provide the link on the blog.
So it's a virtual piece.
But the intensity of the piece was real.
Well, the thing is, we're talking about the Republicans' horse race aspect here too. It's Romney, I believe. It's interesting to watch the pair-offs and the attack. It seems in recent days, Giuliani and Romney have squared off a lot, while Fred Thompson has gone after Mike Huckabee more than the other candidates. And one of the things that Romney, I think, has done is accuse Rudy Giuliani of having run a sanctuary city when he was mayor of New York, and go after Giuliani on the immigration issue. So it would seem that this virtual proposal of Rudy Giuliani's would play into Mitt Romney's hands.
Well, I think it's an interesting struggle, because you're quite right. Romney and Giuliani are both really going at it. They were the lead item on CBS News last night. It was the Romney versus Rudy rumble. Yeah. I'm struck by the fact that in the Republican side and also the Democratic side, the two front runners seem to be, or two major antagonists seem to be going after each other, which leaves room for a third to come along. There's a phrase in Latin called the tertius gaudens, the happy third, which is the person sitting there watching while two antagonists destroy each other, or at least injure each other. And I have thought to myself that McCain or Thompson or Huckabee are standing to benefit from the Rudy Romney rumble.
Which explains why Thompson's going after Huckabee, because he wants to be in that third man position. Let Giuliani and Romney destroy each other. I don't think that's going to happen, but let them try. And he has to worry about Huckabee, who is actually in second place now, it seems, in Iowa, getting advantage of that. I have completely flipped on one very significant aspect of the Republican race, and that is, I think the guy who's sitting pretty at the moment, John McCain. No one's attacking him.
Right.
He was sort of written off, and if you think about the Republican race right now, Rudy Giuliani, because of his social positions, they're finally coming to haunt him, and they seem to be dragging him down. Mitt Romney, Mormon, a flip-flopper, he's not a good match, I think, for the Republican primary voters overall. And so McCain, in a lot of ways, by the numbers, on paper, is indeed, I think, the best match at the moment. What has he been doing the last 5 years, 4 years? He's been defending Bush's war. He's been in the trenches doing more than any of these other guys. Fred Thompson voted for the war, then left the Senate. Rudy Giuliani's been out making millions of dollars with Bernard Kerik and other sleazy characters. Mitt Romney, where was his leadership on the number one issue of our generation, the war in Iraq? Nowhere to be seen. McCain's been doing the heavy lifting. Republicans, who still tend to favor the war, should be rewarding him and praise of him. I mean, Huckabee, who has done well on the social conservative positions, he hasn't been out front on this paramount matter. So I'm looking at McCain. Republican voters, don't you see? The answer is right in front of your face. It's the guy who, John McCain.
Republican viewers on Blogging Heads, I think you should detect a little bit of setup there.
But I mean this. I mean, look, he's been right on abortion, even though they don't believe him. He's voted for most of the tax cuts, not always been in big favor of tax cuts, but he goes after the pork and the earmarks, which, wasteful government spending. What is John McCain wrong on?
He's wrong on
immigration.
He's wrong on immigration. He's wrong on McCain-Feingold, which is a real bone of contention out there among...
Oh, Republican primary voters don't care about it. The activist groups care, activists, but the voters don't.
But David, who votes in Iowa? Activists. I mean, remember, Iowa is 3 million people, and maybe 100,000 people will vote in the Republican caucuses. So that means that's 3%. If you boil your population down to 3% of the... That means only the activists are showing up. I think don't underestimate the McCain-Feingold as a distinct negative in McCain. And also, there's got to say, this is the Kyoto Treaty. McCain is exactly the type who would prosecute the war in Iraq, raise taxes, and sign the Kyoto Treaty. And that is a formula for, being unpopular inside the Republican Party, that kind of big government conservatives run amok.
He is the only Republican candidate in the first or second tier who has put his money where his mouth is on the war. I disagree with him on the war, of course, but you do too.
Right.
And it's kind of amazing that he's not reaping any gains from that.
He looks old. I mean, he doesn't look like a dynamic, healthy person. And presidency is intense. And if you think about how much a president ages in his years in office, I mean, look at how much older Bush looks compared to 7 years ago. Bush looks a lot better now after 8 years, 7 years in office than McCain does after no years in office. Imagine what McCain would be like after 4 years or 8 years in the White House. But we should introduce one more figure in the Republican race who I think is going to pull a surprise, and I will make this prediction. He's going to make some big jump somewhere, is Ron Paul. You can't be raising the kind of money that Ron Paul's getting. You can't have the kind of visibility that Ron Paul has. You go to an event, you go to a political event, you've seen him if you've been on Republican. The Ron Paul sign holders, the Ron Paul activists and bloggers, the kind of people who flame you if you say something bad about him, they are really, really out there and strong, and they're doing all sorts of creative things to help the campaign. For example, in addition to having these sort of money bombs where they raise $5 million in a single day, which is a lot of dough, I don't know if you've run across, have you seen the Ron Paul blimp?
I haven't seen the Ron Paul blimp, but I did get a solicitation for the recent money bomb, which was a couple of days ago, which I don't think was as successful as the previous one, which had a picture. This was from one of his support groups. Had a picture of a couple of white guys being handcuffed and carted off by federal state troopers wearing black masks coming from black helicopters. So Ron Paul is certainly winning the black helicopter vote. I will grant you that. But, you know, listen, I know Pat Buchanan, and Ron Paul is no Pat Buchanan. I think, Pat Buchanan, 96, was able to surprise, Bob Dole in New Hampshire and come on strong and win in New Hampshire. He couldn't sustain it, obviously, because he, was more a fringe candidate than a mainstream candidate. Fringe candidates, by definition, don't tend to win. But, Ron Paul has a lot of committed zealots behind him. But this guy, listen, he got a donation from a neo-Nazi fellow and refused to give it back. I mean, there's Ron Paul, has like a couple of has many 434 to 1 votes in the House, and he just he has that committed crusading cult behind him, but it can't take him above 8%.
I'll bet it does in New Hampshire. And here's the point. This goes back to the McCain business, and that is, I agree. McCain will get nowhere in Iowa because the activists aren't for him. He would, for all the reasons you said earlier, have a chance of winning New Hampshire in a way that he did back in 2000. But I think that the challenge he faces, the bad luck he faces, is that although support for the war is a major selling point among big chunks of Republicans, and McCain will get them, or at least get a lot of them. Opposition to the war is also a big selling point among, obviously, a different set of Republicans who are more numerous than you would know from the arrangement of the Republican candidates, most of whom, or all of whom, except Paul, support the war. But Paul, therefore, has got the entire anti-war Republican vote to himself, and all these libertarians across the country, including, I see Dennis Kucinich, sort of went out of his way to say nice things about Ron Paul, which is a reminder of something I've said on the show before, which is the sort of the essential symmetry between the sort of left-wing libertarians and the right-wing libertarians. And
on foreign policy matters, but not on anything else.
On drugs is another issue. A lot of social libertarian issues, they're sort of similar on a lot. Not all, but a lot. Anyway, I will predict that Ron Paul does really, really well in New Hampshire, and I wouldn't be surprised. If the field's sufficiently divided, I wouldn't be surprised if he wins.
Write this down. Put it in the bank. Put it in the safety deposit box. This is not a virtual prediction. This is a real prediction. Ron Paul wins in the live free or die state.
I said I wouldn't be surprised if he does.
And will he be, if he wins, will he be flown from his victory celebration in a black helicopter?
Well, no, the point is the blimp.
The Ron Paul blimp.
If you go to Ron, I looked it up, ronpaulblimp.com. I mean, it's just a reminder. That's the point is, there's so many people who like Paul out there who aren't in the current political matrix. They aren't political consultants.
Yeah, right.
They're just sort of citizens who are excited over Paul.
And they're printing their own money. They're actually printing their own money with his picture on it and being arrested by the IRS
it. That's really,
now, that's commitment. You don't see Fred Thompson supporters doing that and going to jail for their man.
You're right. Listen, that one measure of a campaign is the kind of sort of quantum foam around the campaign of activists buzzing around doing stuff. So I think but you're right. The printing money one was kind of funny.
Let's talk before we go to the Dems. Let's talk about your old favorite,
Huckabee.
Huckabee. Doing very well in Iowa. Finally, Iowans realized that Rudy Giuliani is not with them on abortion and gay marriage, and that Mitt Romney was a flip-flopper. Sam Brownback, maybe he's, regretting dropping out when he did, because eventually it seems these social conservative voters decided that they want someone who thinks and prays like they do. And so they really have no one to turn to in that regard except for Mike Huckabee, and you know he's in a virtual tie with Mitt Romney. He's raised not nearly as much money as anybody else in the race. He is poised to do well. It may be hard to win because if without the money and the infrastructure, Iowa, as you know, it's the cliche, is about bringing your voters to the caucuses and making them stand in corners and gymnasiums and do what they have to do. He may not be fully able to take advantage of the popular support that may hamper him in the final showings. But how far can Mike Huckabee go?
Well, I think he could easily win Iowa. In spite of all the difficulties, in spite of the fact that Romney can spend, you know, 10, 20, 50, who knows how much money he'll actually have spent in Iowa. You sort of every time you turn around, you find somebody else on the Romney payroll, present company accepted, of course. Although, who knows? I mean, again, I'm just kidding there. But there
okay,
are,
Jim, okay,
hired
Jim.
A lot of, Romney's hired
Jim?
A lot of people spend a lot of money.
Jim, what's your price? Name it right here. I'm sure we can get Mitt on the phone. Working out a deal?
I think that, look, Huckabee has the conservative evangelical support, as you mentioned. He's also got the support of sort of blue-collar Republicans, you know, the non-hedge fund Republicans, who worry about things like health care, who worry about trade. And he's swung around on immigration so that he's got a position now which is much more in line.
Now,
with
Fred, you know, now Fred Thompson has been attacking him, as we talked about earlier, for not being a true conservative, for having been a big raiser of taxes and when he was governor of Arkansas. You've had the Club of Growth, this economic libertarian outfit that has been, you know, turned basically into the anti-Huckabee campaign in Iowa. He calls them the club for greed, the club of greed.
Club for greed.
You know, is Mike Huckabee not truly a fiscal conservative?
I think he's no libertarian, that's for sure. And I think he is a moderate conservative, I would call him. And that may not be good enough for the Club for Growth, which has been, you know, primarying moderate Republicans with, you know, extreme Republicans for the last few years, last couple election cycles. And Thompson, you know, may not be good for Thompson either. I mean, look, Fred Thompson, I think, took an interesting detour, which I'm sure pleased the Club for Growth, which is he trotted out a new privatizing Social Security plan, which I don't think has much support out there. I know it'll never get through the Congress. And I don't think Republican voters really care very much about it. I think the whole thing with the Bush plan from a couple years ago was a big dud. It was catnip here inside the Beltway, and not much made not much of an impression outside the Beltway. So I think that Thompson is playing to the think tanks here in town, and Huckabee is playing to, you know, to borrow a phrase, Applebee's America. You know, the book from a couple of years ago about sort of, you know, ordinary Americans who do worry about their health care, who do worry about trade, who do worry about immigration, who do worry about sort of family values, traditional values. Huckabee's got a great message for them, which in many ways kind of overlaps with John Edwards, if you ask me.
Now, the interesting thing about Huckabee is, while he seems to be nowhere in New Hampshire, you know, the next big contest, you know, take away some of the disputed races in Michigan and Florida, the next big contest is going to be South Carolina, where, of course, social conservatives run the place in terms of the Republican primary. Can he, if he does well in Iowa, can he sort of survive? Can he be the Jimmy Carter of the Republican Party?
I had that thought myself.
In 76, yes. Jimmy Carter was the governor of a small state, Georgia, ex-governor, came from nowhere, did well in Iowa, and sort of, you know, then kind of, you know, ran away with
it. Certainly, for example, Thompson has to do well in South Carolina. He can survive. They think the Thompson campaign thinks that it can survive being defeated in Iowa. They have no real prospects of winning Iowa. They don't really think they have much of a chance in New Hampshire, but they do think they can win or have to win South Carolina. But if you're rejoining us here at Blogging Heads TV, we had a little technical difficulty here.
There was a little glitch there. But that happens when you talk about, not just on the campaign trail, but when you talk about the campaign trail. So should we move on to Democrats?
We should move. We're done with Huckabee. We're done with Thompson. Let's move on to Democrats. Yes, sir.
Okay. You referred to this earlier, but the big battle of the last few days has really been between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And not only are they mixing it up, they're dragging into their fight Bill Clinton and Oprah Winfrey, who both will be campaigning up a storm in the next few weeks in Iowa. And also, Hillary Clinton, out of the blue, brought in another heavy hitter, Barbara Streisand. So Barbara and Bill versus Oprah, I don't know how these Iowans are going to sort everything out. But there was, you know, we talked early in the show about how watching how someone campaigns and the type of campaign they run does give you a lot of information in terms of what type of president they might be. Clinton's campaign the other day jumped on a story in the Washington Post. The Post reported that Barack Obama has one of these leadership PACs. He calls his Hope Fund. And leadership PACs are political action committees that a lot of prominent folks who are going to run for president, members of Congress, the House and the Senate, put together, and they use these to collect money that they above and beyond what they can get for their own campaigns, and they dole out that money to possible political supporters across the country, people running for office, and also they use it to commission polls, to pay their staff, their political staff in between campaigns. So it's a little bit of a quasi-legal slush fund.
It's legal. I got to say it's legal.
It is legal. There's some reform critics who say that it is a violation, and they've been trying to get the FEC to rule against these leadership funds. But nevertheless, it does seem to be legal. The Post had a piece about Barack Obama's leadership PAC, noting that in the last few months he's given out $180,000 to candidates, to politicians in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. What do they all have in common, folks? And so right away, the Hillary campaign puts out a press release accusing him of committing campaign violations and calling him to come clean and answer questions about his campaign violations. Well, wait a second. I do a little reporting. You know, that's what us reporters do. By that, I mean I Google Hillary leadership and leadership pack, and it doesn't take too long to find out, of course, which I knew already. She has her own. It's called Hillpack. And last year, the Washington Post did a same newspaper, without noting it this time, did a story on her Hill PAC and noted that she'd been giving out tens of thousands of dollars to people running for office in, guess what states? Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. So she's exactly doing exactly what she was accusing Barack Obama of doing. Now, is that desperation? Are they just looking to throw the kitchen sink at it and do whatever they can? She was mocking him the other day for having said that living overseas was going to help him in terms of foreign policy. So derision, hypocrisy. What other arrows does she have in that quiver of hers?
Opportunism.
Well, maybe that too.
She flipped on the driver's license thing pretty quickly when she felt the pressure to do so. I'm a little puzzled over what's going on here, and maybe you can, since you're a reporter and you're out there with, you know, good access to Google and so on.
I'll send you the link.
the presumption that's guided people's, at least my thinking about the campaign, the Democratic campaign for the last 6 months, is that the Hillary Clinton campaign has some kind of dirt on Obama that has kept him from really taking the gloves off on her. And the Bob Novak.
Well, Bob Novak floated that, and that's one reason. Reason not to believe it begin with.
Novak. You say what you want about him. I mean,
he then ran away from the story too.
He's a hardworking reporter who gets stuff.
Wrong.
Now, if you're saying, I'm perfectly happy to believe. I'm perfectly happy to listen to you saying that. No, actually, in fact, there's never been any trepidation on Obama's part about trashing Hillary. The Hillary campaign has no intention of nuking Obama on Tony Reschke or something like that. If you say so, I'll at least listen to you.
I think Barack Obama's hands are tied for a completely different matter. He's run as the candidate of hope, of being above the fray, beyond partisan politics. I think that limits, you know, how sharp he can be in attacking anyone, whether they're members of his own party or members of the opposing party. I also think there's another dimension to this. Barack Obama, last time I checked, is an African-American. And we don't talk a lot about the prospect or the difficulty of a black man becoming president in this country, but certainly I think most people would agree that the prospect of an angry-looking black person becoming president would be even harder than a pleasant, hopeful-looking black person. So I think he's, you know, he's done, you know, through his career, and I, you know, and this I'm not saying this is purely for tactical reasons. I mean, I've met him a few times. I mean, it does seem genuine. You know, he's a guy who is forceful and passionate and cares about issues. I mean, he was a community organizer when Hillary was looking to, you know, become a corporate lawyer in Arkansas. He cares about things and he does the heavy lifting, but he, you know, he doesn't come across as angry. I'm not sure he even feels angry about the injustices that he himself has dedicated his life to dealing with. So for those reasons alone, I think he does feel uncomfortable, or it's just not his nature to go for the juggler. Unlike John Edwards, who of course, right, you know, right, was a trial attorney, in which your obligation to your client is to go for the juggler in terms of the opposition. And we talked before about the happy third man. You use some fancy Latin phrase to describe this, which I won't even try to repeat.
Because you don't remember, that's why.
Of course they don't.
Tertius Gaudens.
Yes, but so here, you know, Edwards has been turning up the heat too on Hillary Clinton, saying that he can shake up and change things in Washington, and she's in bed with corporate lobbyists and obviously cannot. Now, the question is for Edwards is, how far is he willing to go, realizing that the beneficiary of his attacks might not be himself, but actually Barack Obama?
All right, that's what I think. I think actually that although I realize that Hillary and Obama have been mixing up somewhat, I think the real mixing going on and will continue is Edwards versus Hillary, and that Obama actually stands then to be the happy third, and if he's got the sort of good nature that I agree he does appear to have, yeah, and a guy who isn't that threatening to, you know, middle America, then if Edwards, who obviously has much more of a killer instinct, and the Hillary campaign with Carville and all those other people floating around, clearly they're assassins, you know, at least in a political sense. So I think that the real negativity is Edwards and the back and forth thing. And I find it entirely possible now that Hillary could come in second or third in Iowa.
Well, I think third would be a pretty far drop for her. The question that I wrote about earlier in the week was, where is her firewall? Is it New Hampshire? Is it South Carolina? New Hampshire, you know, just recently picked its date for the primary, January 8th. That's 5 days after January 3rd, which is the Iowa caucuses. Someone has a surprise win there. It seems to me that, you know, that the whole momentum that one assumes will be thrust upon, a thrust behind, the winner of Iowa on the Democratic side. Can you keep that going for 5 days. I'm not sure you could keep it going for 3 weeks, but you really, you know, can keep it going for a couple of days, and that may help you a lot in New Hampshire. And if you look at South Carolina, the issue down there, it's interesting. John Edwards has been was born there, though he represented the state of North Carolina in the Senate, but he's far behind in the polls. The issue down there seems to have been so far where the black Democrats, who make up a pretty decent portion of the Democratic electorate there, are going to go for Hillary, who was married to this first black president. I'm doing the quotation mark thing in the air thing. You can't see. Or they're going to go for the guy who could actually be the first black president without quotation marks. And if Obama should happen to win in Iowa, and you have the very real possibility of a black person becoming a presidential nominee, what might that do for black voters in South Carolina?
That's a good question, and don't forget Oprah. I actually not very convinced that Barbara Streisand moves many votes outside of Manhattan or Beverly Hills, but I think Oprah clearly does. And Bill Clinton, frankly, does too. For also returning back to Hillary's side of things, look, it's an incredible turn of events. Because when I said Hillary could come in third, it could be a close third. I mean, bear in mind, I mean, that right now Edwards, Hillary, and Obama are all in the mid 20s. I mean, they're all clustered around there, well within the margin of error on most of these polls. So any one of the three could come in first, second, or third.
And there's going to be a lot of strategizing, as President Bush might say, in terms of what is the threshold you need to be counted at a caucus. I think it's 15%. So this always happens. The campaigns, the leading candidates who know they will be above 15%, you know, start cutting deals with other candidates. Well, if you don't make the 15%, will you come to our corner of the gymnasium? And if you watch, you know, I listen, I'm a tremendous C-SPAN fan. And last time around I wasn't able to get out to Iowa, and I watched, they had a couple different caucuses going on C-SPAN. And you could see, the people in charge of the back of the pack candidates had their marching orders. Okay, we don't get the 15%, then we're supposed to go to Dean, Kerry, Gebhardt, whoever it was. And
that's a third point, because obviously if Hillary is mixing it up with her main antagonist, whoever her main antagonist proves to be, whether it's Edwards or Obama, then one would imagine that the hard feelings there would make it very hard for anybody to slip across and go to the other side. And then meanwhile,
what you're doing is you're looking at the Biden voters, the Dodd voters.
Right.
Those are the people. And if the race is going to be as close as Jim Pinkerton thinks it's going to be, that could be the difference. If Hillary cuts a deal with Biden, forget about Richard Holbrook. You're my Secretary of State. Well, that actually, because Biden's not doing so bad in Iowa, or with Richardson.
Or Richardson.
Oh, forget Biden and Richard Holbrook. You're my Secretary of State.
But hold on.
Oh, you're my
David. Both Richardson, Biden, and of course Holbrook all want to be Hillary's Secretary of State.
But Richardson Bill Richardson might settle for Vice President. So these deals can be arranged, up to the last minute, and could be the proverbial tipping point.
Right, the entire government could get filled up just on the basis of what happens in Iowa.
Yes, so those 100,000 Iowan voters, God bless them all.
Every one of them gets a cabinet job.
Yes. Well, I think we've covered the territory here.
I think we have, yes.
So, as always, it's been fun, Jim, and I'll
see you
down the road.
I'll see you on the road.